Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Everyone, I'm Gary Noel. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how compromised is your immune system. I'll give you an idea of that, and how a shingles vaccine is creating shingles. Also, we're going to talk about fried food, grilled food, or baked food can impact type 2 diabetes. That's from the School of Medicine, Mount Sinai. Also, increasing vitamin D, which we should be doing, can reduce homocysteine concentrations, and that in turn lessens your likelihood of a heart attack or stroke, University of Alberta. Also, a simple saline spray, something you could just cost you a buck or two, spray it in your nose, and that can be as effective as medicine for chronic nosebleeds, University of Utah, and much more on health and healing. Also, from the environment, the melting, which is happening all over the northern tundras, all over the boreal forest, is now releasing long-dormant anthrax, and that is dangerous. Also, 10 states report crop damage from illegal dicamba use on Monsanto GMO seeds, and Italy just banned Monsanto's top-selling herbicide from all public places. Also today, I'm going to share some brief commentaries that I think are important. For example, we never hear anyone discussing the bubbles. Well, we have an equity bubble, and it's huge. It's the largest bubble out there, and at least the average person be aware of, and that's about 18,000, and it should be closer to 6,000. So when that crashes, and it will, it's inevitable, someone's going to lose $20 trillion. We also have a $1 trillion consumer auto loan bubble, and that's beginning to burst. I'll give you the latest from that from Michael Snyder. And then I'm going to tie in several things that you have not heard of. You probably have never heard of an individual who is a whistleblower. His name is Bradley Birkenfeld. And Bradley used to find ways of hiding money for his clients at UBS. And UBS is the world's largest wealth manager. They're in Switzerland. And then he blew the whistle. He spent a short period of time in jail. And then they gave him $104 million. That's our IRS gave him $104 million. Why? Because he found billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in unpaid taxes that they were able to recover. Now, why is that important? Because of Hillary Clinton's association with a lot of the people who were hiding the money, including Saudi Arabia. And then there's a connection between the Podesta group that you haven't heard about. You will. You'll hear about Tony Podesta and John Podesta. He chairs Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. And what role do they have to play in Saudi Arabia? A big role. But also it gets deeper than that. It also gets to what Obama doesn't want you to know about Uzbekistan. Never heard of Uzbekistan? Well, most people haven't. Couldn't find it on a map. But don't let that fool you. It's a very important country. The leader of the country just died. And he was 82-year-old, total tyrant. Just one of the world's most corrupt dictators. But he was our friend. He was our ally. Well, how is it that we went after Gaddafi, and he did a lot for his people, most prosperous in Africa, and this guy just destroyed his people? Well, I'll show you the connections and why this story isn't being discussed. Also today, we're going to continue with what I started yesterday. It's a three-part series. It's an ex-Israeli soldier speaking out about how he awakened from the dream state that he was in about what it means to be a soldier overseeing the Palestinians and then the reality. And we left off yesterday where he had been awakened in the middle of the night. His buddy had just come back, and he said, "We thought we killed a young kid." And they went out, and they surrounded the house because it was a Jewish holiday, so they weren't allowed. They had a curfew. And so 180,000 people had to stay in their homes, but they wouldn't allow this person out to bury his son, this little boy. So then he got angry. He was yelling at the Israelis. So they arrested him. That's typically what they do. And he dropped him off at the police headquarters. That's where we left off. We'll pick up on that also. And then I was traveling today, and I'm switching across the radio to hear who's talking about what issues. And I heard Glenn Beck mocking Hillary Clinton's cough. Bill O'Reilly last night mocked her. "It's not important. Get on with the cough. Business is all nonsense, you know." No, it isn't. In my career, I've had an opportunity to counsel a lot of people with brain conditions, including working specifically in 1 2-year study with people with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. What you will frequently see with people with Parkinson's is you'll see a non-productive dry cough that can go on for 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes that has nothing to do with allergies because they cannot control the nerve stimulation to their lungs and the bronchospasms. Also, when you suddenly see someone who you can tell in a moment it's not a seizure they're having, nor a mini stroke, they're going into a disconnect because of brain damage where they lose spatial awareness, meaning one moment they're there and the next second they're not. Then they come back and they don't know how long they've been away. Might have been 2 seconds, might have been 10 seconds, and they pick up. And we've seen this repeatedly. So I would ask the question, is it not reasonable to expect Hillary Clinton to turn over all of her medical records so that we can see how much damage she actually sustained from the blood clot, from the concussion? Because all the symptoms I'm seeing, anyone who's dealt with brain injured people have seen repeatedly. So it's a responsible and reasonable request for what would be the most important position, because behind that frequently comes dementia. And I believe it's very important that we know the total mental health of anyone running for president. So I'm going to have a medical doctor, 37 years of experience, show you some of the medical indications. And all we can do at this moment is put it out there to say it's time that the left stop defending her and just have it take a look. Also, she was bragging yesterday on with Matt Lauer, Hillary Clinton, about how she saved Libya. There wasn't a single death, American death. And she saved Libya from being massacred by its own people. She portrayed herself as a hero, how she engaged with the Arab League and got them on board, and how she engaged with NATO. And Matt Lauer, unfortunately, in this instance, completely unprepared and clueless. And by the way, what was that little device in Hillary's ear? Well, if she's having hearing problems and it's a hearing aid, fine. We should know. I would hate to think that someone would have a hearing piece in their ear to be coached when they're in any public forum. And in any case, I'd just like to know what it is. Clearly, it is some form of hearing piece in her ear. You can see it if you blow up the... And as a cinematographer, as someone who directs films, which I'm doing now, and does photography, which I do, that's one of my hobbies, you pay attention to these little things. In any case, Matt Lauer let it go. Instead of asking, we have on the screen here some photographs of Libya prior to its invasion that you led. You are aware, Clinton, that Libya was the most prosperous country in all of Africa, that they had no debt, they had no terror, they had no violence, that there were it was the most open religious community. Every kind of religion was accepted. Women had more positions of power than any other place, including Israel, in the Middle East. There was more sense of democracy than any other country. More of the money came in from oil was shared directly into the state funds, which were then allocated to individuals. Free education, free medical, a free home, a large grant when you were given when you were pregnant. If you wanted to be a farmer, they bought you a farm, they paid for your equipment, they paid for your seeds, plus all these humanitarian projects they were doing, which were remarkable. Now there are 50,000 dead Libyans. The country is divided. There's more than 200 fighting factions there now. So please explain to us how Libya is a better place because you took responsibility for creating this. And it's unfortunate that the American media does not have any sense of scholarship, and that's what we get because of it. Anyhow, I'm going to play you something about why Hillary Clinton's war record matters. So you see, we have a packed show today. And I will take time in the middle of the show to give you a report to the listeners. This is my own informal report, and it's just for our sister station in New York City. We're syndicated all over the United States. We're heard all over the world. We're in over 170 countries. We're the number one listened to radio program, progressive radio program in the world. But I apologize in advance for the other stations because this does not involve you, but it's certainly something we can all learn a lesson from. Some people have nosebleeds. According to the Journal of the American Medical Association, squirting a simple saline solution, the salt solution, into the nose twice a day could alleviate chronic nosebleeds just as effectively as spraying any one of three different medications. Quote from the Journal of the American Medical Association, this research highlights that there could be a benefit even in the simplest of interventions. That was from the University of Utah School of Medicine director. So, boy, that's nice. Inexpensive, easy, non-toxic, and can help stop nosebleeds. Now, you would think that with as many people out in the sun, that we'd all be getting enough vitamin D, but we don't, especially those living in northern latitudes who have long commutes, and frequently are in the car, subway, or buses, trains, prior to the sun, get into offices, and then go home after the sun is on the way down. So they're not getting sun. It's that simple. Here's what's important about getting the sun. This is the University of Alberta, published in PLOS One. They have now found an association between vitamin D with reducing your homocysteine concentrations. Now, homocysteine is an inflammatory marker. So when it's elevated, that's a bad thing. You don't want that because you'll have a greater incidence of heart attacks, strokes, and cancer. You want to keep the homocysteine level down. Well, there's a couple ways of doing it. You can certainly bring it down by taking vitamin B12, vitamin B6, folic acid, and vitamin C, and trimethylglycine. Those five nutrients will just drop it right down, and that's generally what I recommend. But they're saying vitamin D also does it. So, get your vitamin D. Either supplement with about 3,000 to 5,000 units a day or get out in the sun for about 20 minutes a day. From the School of Medicine, Mount Sinai, they're saying this, quote, changing the way you cook could help reduce your risk of getting type 2 diabetes. Boiling, steaming, and poaching look like the safest way to go. But when you fry, or you grill, or you bake foods, also called dry heat cooking, foods produce substances called advanced glycation end products. High levels of these advanced glycation end products have been linked to insulin resistance, stress on the body's cells, and inflammation. These are troublemakers in terms of diabetes risk. Insulin is a hormone that helps blood sugar from food get into the cells for energy. Without insulin or with insulin resistance, too much sugar remains in the blood, and that can lead to serious problems for the eyes, the heart, the kidneys, and other organs. Quote, when you look at people with chronic disease like type 2 diabetes or dementia, put on a high age diet, that's the advanced glycation end products, those on the low age diet show signs of decreasing inflammation. That's the professor of medicine, Icahn School of Medicine, Mount Sinai. So, that's all good. It's good to know this. It's good that this was done at a highly respected university and published in a peer-reviewed journal. Now, here's what's interesting. When was the first time people in this audience heard me talk about, remember, you got a plump chicken, moist and wet, you put it in the oven, and 2 hours later it comes out brown and dry and leathery? And I talked about the aging process being sped up, the telomeres being shortened. You literally die quicker the more these fried foods, processed foods, high-protein foods with sugar. That's the advanced aging process. That was over 20 years ago. So they caught up with us 20 years late. Well, we're far ahead from them now, but at least they're getting the basics right, and that's good. And one more thing, Merck says their shingles vaccine may spread shingles. Natural Health 365, quote, "The world of vaccines just keeps getting more bizarre, and the reality of vaccine side effects more grim. Now a major shingles vaccine manufacturer is admitting that their vaccine may actually cause the spread of shingles. In addition to being linked with numerous other disturbing vaccine dangers, shingles is an extremely painful blistering skin rash caused by the herpes zoster virus. It also has been linked with chickenpox or the varicella virus. Merck, maker of the shingles vaccine, listed the spread of shingles as one of the vaccine's side effects of the drug." Okay. And by the way, the more immune compromised you are, mainly through stress, not sleeping, and then being stressed, your immune system just takes a tumble. And that's why when people come to see me almost always with shingles, I ask them, what's really been stressing? Oh, I just had this. And it's almost always after that you get these shingles outbreaks. But you also get herpes outbreaks. You get a outbreak of a cytomegalovirus, an Epstein-Barr virus, a Coxsackie virus. So viruses really love it when you are not sleeping, you're stressed, and your immune system is weak. So what can you do about it? First, get good night rest. And here's a simple little way that you can stop having sleepless nights if the sleeplessness is due to stress. Beside your bed, have a notepad, and very methodically each night while you're in bed, write down a number, the biggest problems and issues in your life, and how tomorrow you're going to address them. And 1, 2, 3, 4, you just write them down. And then read each one. This whole thing may take you 5 minutes. And then when you put that pad and pen down, your brain disconnects from having to think about it in that moment. And you can allow the other side of the brain to take over and put you into a deep sleep. Because one of the reasons we don't sleep is because we're worried. We're thinking about things. This is something I found that helps me sleep. When I lay down, I don't sleep much, but when I lay down, I'm out instantly, within 60 seconds. Because I don't take my problems and thoughts and anxiety or anything that may exist, don't take it sleep with me. Then I wake up in the morning, I can deal with it. Also, for those of you who suffer from shingles, vitamin C is one of the finest antiviral natural agents that can help you eradicate the shingles virus, especially at high doses. And if you were to use an intravenous drip starting at around 35,000 milligrams twice a week and go up from there, you can frequently knock out the virus completely, but not at low doses. You have to get a high one. You have to get with a physician that knows how to use it for shingles. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Woo-hoo! Hit
I'd like to welcome all of you. We're always doing something that brings us up to a cutting edge. And right now, we are, this coming Sunday, we're going to have a 7-hour and possibly an 8-hour special, all brand new information from some of the world's leading scientists and engineers on deconstructing the myth of 9/11. I'm not allowing on the show hypotheses, postulates. I'm allowing only concrete evidence. So it's a program really worth listening to. You can listen to any part of it. It'll start at 6 p.m. this Sunday on the Progressive Radio Network. If you want to listen to it, any part of it, I'll give you the numbers. You can listen live over the telephone or any portable listening device. Write this number down, 424-203-8046, 424-203-8046. Or let's say you don't have time Sunday evening to listen. You want to listen the next day. You can call and download any part of that from the archives. 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. This is a historic program. It's taken us over a year to produce this, and the people we have on are the most credible, credentialed, with new information. This simply makes everything else obsolete. Also this Saturday, from 3 to 6, next to the last meeting for our health support group, so please, those of you who are in the program, make sure you show up. A whole lot of new information being given to you at that time. From the environmental segment today, from Natural Blaze, Italy just banned Monsanto's top-selling herbicide. Quote, Italy just put massive restrictions on the use of Monsanto's probably carcinogenic herbicide Roundup, just as studies suggesting it is more toxic than previously assumed come under public scrutiny. Italy's Minister of Health has banned the spraying of the main ingredient in Roundup, glyphosate, in many public places that affect vulnerable groups, including courtyards, gardens, roadways, sports fields, recreational areas, playgrounds, green areas outside of school buildings, and additional green spaces. Additionally, pre-harvest desiccation, the process of spraying crops with glyphosate before harvesting, has also been banned, as has the non-agriculture use of glyphosate on soils composed of 80% or more of sand, a measure designed to protect groundwater from further agricultural contamination. All told, Italy has just adopted one of the largest bans on the agricultural and public use of glyphosate in the country's history. Good. Now, why can't cities in the United States, states in the United States, do the same thing? Why is it we have to see countries outside the United States banning something that we should have banned a long time ago? Follow the money trail to our legislators. Follow how they elected a pro-GMO head of Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, and you'll understand. Separately, from EchoWatch, 10 states report crop damage from illegal dicamba use on Monsanto's GMO seeds. Quote, to the horror of farmers across America's farm belt, hundreds of thousands of crop acres have been adversely impacted by the apparent misuse of the drift-prone herbicide dicamba on Monsanto's Roundup Ready X10 soybean and cotton plants. According to a recent Environmental Protection Agency compliance advisory, the EPA and state agencies have received, quote, unusually high numbers of reports of crop damage that appear related to the illegally spraying of dicamba. The EPA has collected similar reports of crop damage from Missouri, Alabama, Arkansas, Illinois, Kentucky, Minnesota, Mississippi, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas. Missouri appears to have suffered the most, and they have a lot of complaints covering over 40,000 acres. Now, why is this important? Why should you care? Because what if the peaches, the tomatoes, the cantaloupes, the watermelons, the rice, the corn, the peas, and the peanuts, the alfalfa, and soybeans, all grown in Missouri on those fields? I wouldn't want to be eating anything that had been sprayed. So both of those stories involve Monsanto. And who heads food safety at the FDA? Monsanto former's lawyer, Michael Taylor. Now, I want to take on a few more issues. I thought this would be of interest to you because it deals with several things that are all interconnected. First, who controls the money? Your local bank? The Federal Reserve? Who? Well, no. In an incredibly powerful international organization, according to Michael Snyder of Economic Collapse blog, controls it all. How so? In fact, the entire money supply of the globe is controlled by the Bank of International Settlements. Now, it's the central bank of central banks, meaning this Basel, Switzerland-located bank, it controls money everywhere. Okay, well, that's not illegal. Might not even be unethical, unless you understand they're not elected. They're unaccountable. You cannot do anything to them. They act in complete immunity from taxation and from national laws. There is no country's laws that can supersede that against the Bank of International Settlements. Even Wikipedia goes this far, quote, "It is not accountable to any single national government," end quote. Now, the Bank of International Settlements was used to launder money for the Nazis during World War II, but these days the main purpose of the Bank of International Settlements is to guide and direct the centrally planned global financial system. There are 58 global central banks, and they all belong to the Bank of International Settlements. So every 2 months, the central bankers of the world from these 58 global central banks, they meet in secret. In fact, so secret that no one knows who is meeting, no records are allowed to be kept, no recordings. You're not even allowed to bring in a special assistant, a secretary, nothing. And yet everything they do will impact every man, woman, and child on the planet. The Bank of International Settlements is an organization that was founded by the global elite, and it operates for the benefit of the global elite. And it's intended to be one of the key cornerstones of the emerging one-world economy. And it's imperative that people understand that that shouldn't be allowed. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Quote, "Every 2 months, more than a dozen bankers meet here on Sunday evening to talk and dine on the 18th floor of a cylinder-looking building over the Rhine. The dinner discussions on money and economics are more than academic. At the table are the chiefs of the world's biggest central banks, representing countries that annually produce more than $51 trillion of gross domestic product, three-quarters of the world's economic output. The Bank of England's Mr. King leads the dinner discussion in a room decorated by a Swiss architectural Herzog, who designed the Bird's Nest Stadium for the Beijing Olympics. And serious matters follow appetizers, and that's where they get down to talking about what they want the world to be. There are no transcripts, no minutes, no staff of any type is allowed. So just understand that the fate of the world's economy is determined by an unelected central bankers in secret meetings that nobody ever hears about. Am I missing something? Is that supposed to be democratic? And yet not a word anywhere about this. But that is only one part of it, because the largest bank in the world for hiding money historically has been a bank in Switzerland. And that bank is called UBS. And UBS is a bank where tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people hid money. And these people could have been Nazis. They could have been war criminals. They could have been dictators. In fact, just about every bad person, drug dealers, cartel heads, they all hid their money there because they were protected, secret accounts. And then one day, one guy, out of all the thousands and thousands of employees, Bradley Birkenfeld, he starts looking and he finds, gee whiz, these people aren't paying taxes in their countries. They're just stealing money. And so he becomes a whistleblower. Well, for his whistleblowing, they put him in jail for 31 months, and I guess that was supposed to be the end of it. But then when he gets out, they give him $104 million for helping to recover unpaid taxes. And then he gets angry. Why? Because he wanted to come to the United States and testify. He wanted to go to Great Britain and testify. He wanted to tell the U.S. Congress and the American public and the American media what he knows about very powerful people in the United States and other places, but specifically in this case, the United States. And it doesn't matter that these people are, you know, what their political persuasion is. It's that these people are thieves. They didn't pay tax on money. They hid it. So why is that bad? Well, because we don't like to have the people that we've trusted in the media or in politics or corporate America, on the one hand, getting incredibly rich, and on the other hand, paying little or no taxes. So that could be a big embarrassment, especially if they're very strongly politically connected. Now in comes Media Benjamin. I met with media. We had a meeting, I guess it was in the fall, up in Kingston, and we were discussing some issues. And I said, when you write about Hillary Clinton, let me know, because I'm interested in your perspective. Here's what she wrote. Quote, if I told you the Democratic Party lobbyist Tony Podesta, whose brother John Podesta chairs Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, is a registered foreign agent on the Saudi government's payroll, you'd probably think I was a Trump-thumping conspiratorial nutcase. But it's true. The lobbying firm created by both Tony and John Podesta in 1988 receives $140,000 a month from the Saudi government, a government that beheads nonviolent dissidents, uses torture to extract forced confessions, doesn't allow women to drive, and bombs schools, hospitals, and residential neighborhoods in neighboring Yemen. Quote, if Hillary Clinton wants to be a meaningful symbol for human rights and women's empowerment, her campaign must live up to the values she claims to represent. The Podesta Group's filings, which were just about 3 months ago, required under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, shows that Tony Podesta himself oversees the Saudi account. At the same time, Tony Podesta is also the top campaign contributor and bundler for Hillary Clinton. So while one brother runs the campaign, the other brother funds it with earnings that come in part from the Saudis. John and Tony Podesta have been heavyweights in D.C. insider politics for decades. John Podesta served as Bill Clinton's chief of staff, founded the influential D.C. think tank Center for American Progress, which regularly touts Saudi Arabia, and was counselor to President Obama. Tony Podesta was dubbed by the New York Times one of Washington's biggest players. Okay, the brothers seem to have no problem mixing their roles in the same pot. Tony Podesta held a Clinton campaign fundraiser at his home featuring gourmet Italian food cooked by himself and his brother and the campaign chairman. The fundraiser, by the way, came just days after that Tony Podesta filed his Saudi contract in the Justice Department, a contract that initially paid him a project fee of $200,000. And so all those bad things that the Saudis do, beheading people, you know, killing homosexuals, 1,000 lashes to Rauf Badawi, 10 years in prison for simply saying that there should be more democracy. And so then they clean it up by having Hillary Clinton's campaign director and the brother of him take money and then plant good information about Saudi Arabia. And then Saudi Arabia gives $35 million to the Clinton Foundation. Well, and then along comes this fella who's got all this information, including information about how the Saudis also use that bank. And millions and hundreds of millions of dollars went into that account. And gee whiz, did any of that money go to fund the people who were accused of being participants in the 9/11? So if you're the person who knows everybody's money pot, where it came from, where it went, how much is hiding, and then where it went once it was in that account to be used to pay for black ops, for 9/11 planning of the Saudis. Wow. Wonder what the media would do with that when that comes out. And Obama and Hillary Clinton, I'll bet they're very sorry that this dictator, this terrorist, who was president of Uzbekistan, Islam Karimov, died. But if you really care about democracy and transparency and who we do business with, then why is it that we have not asked to see proof of where all of the money went, billions of dollars missing, and where his family ends up controlling all the oil, gas, and mineral wealth in this very geographically and geopolitically strategic country? But it's not gone to the citizens. The average person living in the average Uzbek gets $3 to $8 a day. Why don't you take a look at Kolnera Kemerova, the deceased dictator's flamboyant daughter? She's accused of breaking in over $1 billion in bribes from telecommunications companies seeking permits to do business. And another daughter is linked to shell companies that own gaudy multi-million dollar estates in the United States. So if we really cared about helping democracy and women's rights and human rights around the world, why we are always siding with those that enslave their people, torture their people, are brutal to the people in their countries, and we allow them to take the money that they have stolen, bring it into New York and other places, and buy luxurious estates. So, something to think about. Oh, and by the way, it really is good to be Bill Clinton. Because according to the latest article from the Washington Post from Rosalind Helderman and Michelle Healy, that Bill Clinton, for being just an honorary chancellor of a for-profit college, that his wife got that college when she was Secretary of State to be invited where they were not invited, the Laureate International Universities, to come to this international symposium that the State Department was holding. And so here's this pretty much unknown but for-profit college group, and they gave her husband $17.6 million. And suddenly, they're on an invite list, and they're given special favored positions within the State Department. I'm sure it's just a coincidence that no one invited them, and then he gets $17.6 million, and suddenly they're invited, and they seem to be okay. But that's chump change compared to what he was able to do with his consulting once his wife became Secretary of State. Bill Clinton got contracts from GEMS Education, a secondary education chain based out of Dubai, and the Shangri-La Industries and Wasserman Investment, two companies run by longtime Democratic donors. How much did he get? $65.4 million, while his wife, during 4 years as Secretary of State. So it's good to be Bill Clinton and know that, of course, there is no such thing as quid pro quo in Washington. Certainly wouldn't have been in any in their State Department. Oh, and you know that thing that we talk about today, how there's income inequality, how the wealthiest people, heads of corporations, just keep making more and more money compared to anyone else in their own company? Guess who caused that? Bill Clinton. Quote, Bill Clinton, in 1993, made a major move. And what he did was he provided the initial impetus for the runaway rise in CEO compensation. And the basic history has been described, so it's relatively easy to understand. And this was confirmed by Robert Reich, who participated in the key meetings. While running for president, Clinton had promised to end the tax deductibility of the executive pay over $1 million. And this pledge led to considerable consternation. So what the Clintons did is they allowed companies to give stock options that would be tax deductible. And that's how these guys made off like bandits. So whatever they gave their CEOs, they could deduct it. And therefore, when Clinton was in office, the average CEO of the 350 largest corporations was $4.9 million. And just when he left office, it was now up to $20.3 million. That's all Bill Clinton. So if you want to know about inequality, you can thank Bill Clinton. Now, this is a message for the millennials. Millennials, you're being dealt a bad hand right now, but there's something you can do if you organize and educate and focus your energies, because there's at least, I'm going to guess, 20 million of you capable of working together. First, ask for tuition-free higher education at public schools, not private. Private schools, you want to go there, you have to pay. And public free education should mean no tuition, but your books and your living accommodations you should pay for. Also, how could you do this? You don't want to end up having to live in this fear of always being in debt and never being able to get outside of that. Well, it's relatively easy. If you made one single effort, and that would be to have one law passed that would allow everyone who has taken money outside the United States but not brought it back because they are in favored countries, certainly nothing more than a mailbox, where in the Cayman Islands, the island of Jersey, off the English coast, there's at least Luxembourg, there's at least 20 of these different places where they make money, but they don't bring it back to the United States because they don't want to pay the 35% tax, corporate tax rate in the United States. So fine, get everyone together and lobby, demonstrate, and say one-time tax of 20% and you can bring back all this money. Now, it's estimated anywhere from $16 to $35 trillion is kept offshore by corporations and individuals. Amnesty, they pay 20%. 20% at $30 trillion would be $6 trillion. So suddenly you'd have $6 trillion. With $1.3 trillion, you wipe out all student debt. With $2 trillion, you then go into every ghetto area in the United States, from Detroit to Compton to Newark, and you get this local government to help you. You de-ghettoize it. You build affordable housing of quality, and where nobody can buy it, they have to rent, and the rent is 15% of your income. So even if you're poor, you still will have quality place, and it gets rid of gentrification. You also bring in schools, craft centers, assisted living centers, community gardens, playgrounds. You bring in everything that a community needs and should have in order to be a functioning quality community. That would take $2 trillion and you would de-ghettoize America. We would have thriving inner cities. We would have thriving urban areas. And you'd be able to put people to work at living wage, helping in this process. That still leaves you $3 trillion left over of this wonderful money. And you could use that to reestablish an infrastructure program in the United States, from reforesting lands to fixing dams and dikes and levees and bridges and highways and tunnels and subways and gas mains and water mains. So look at what you've been able to do by simply doing that. One single gesture, and no one's thinking about doing it. They could also offer small business loans at zero interest for those millennials and give a special emphasis to millennials to open up small businesses within communities, providing that if you get the loan, you got to pay a living wage. So those are just some things that I thought would help. And Now, some things that are not being asked, and I'm going to save this for tomorrow's show, but I would like to see all of us begin to focus upon what do we as citizens of the United States need to see our politicians at the local, state, and federal level do so we can reclaim a country worth living in that honors the rule of law for all people, that does not have laws that denigrate, segregate against any groups, where you don't have people who can commit a crime and get away with it because they're rich enough, or because they're part of a police union, or because they're you should be held accountable, no matter who you are. I'm going to give 25 suggestions on tomorrow's show of how we should start to take back America at its highest level of idealism. Let's take a look at why Hillary Clinton's war record matters, and the fact that she bragged about having 90-some-plus generals and admirals on her side. Were these the same generals and admirals that went into Iraq? Were these the same who oversaw Abu Ghraib prison? Were these the ones that were blowing up Fallujah? Which ones? I'm curious about their actual background. Here's why it matters.
Clinton wants to be commander-in-chief, and she has more foreign policy experience than anyone running for president. She even brags about it when she can.
Yeah, I was very flattered when Henry Kissinger said I ran the State Department better than anybody had run it in a long time.
But she might not want to name drop a guy who orchestrated coups, propped up dictators, and probably violated international law. And experience isn't the same thing as success. What's Clinton's track record when it comes to U.S. intervention abroad, and why does it matter? Everyone knows that back in 2002, Senator Clinton voted for the invasion of Iraq. Even though she now admits that it was a mistake, has she learned from it? Well, her actions at the State Department are telling. Let's start with the bombing of Libya during the Arab Spring. Clinton was the Obama administration's most influential advocate in toppling the Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Using flawed intelligence from Libyan opposition leaders, she pressured President Obama to join coalition forces, despite resistance from members of his cabinet. Following the death of Gaddafi, NATO bombing ended, but Clinton had no strategy for securing the country after his overthrow. The chaos that followed, free-flowing weapons and armed militias, have turned Libya into a country with competing governments, no rule of law, and a growing ISIS presence. Still, the former Secretary of State seems to be proud of her role in regime change in Libya.
Libya actually held elections. They elected moderates. They have tried to piece together a government against a lot of really serious challenges.
But Libya isn't the only case of Clinton's militaristic approach. Whenever the Obama administration was divided about using force, Clinton was on team intervention. She repeatedly advocated for the 2009 decision to send thousands of troops to continue the war in Afghanistan. Vice President Joe Biden and others opposed it. But even after leaving the State Department, Clinton has been vocal in her readiness to take on conflict around the world. When it comes to Iran, Clinton's publicly supported diplomacy and the deal. But at a time when the U.S. is dropping sanctions, Clinton says there should be new ones.
Which is really a very retrograde posture, something that's not shared by pretty much anyone within the Democratic Party.
On Syria, Clinton's distanced herself from Obama. She's called for a more aggressive approach, including a no-fly zone, more airstrikes, more special ops, and
ground forces actually taking back more territory from ISIS.
Then there's Latin America. Clinton's record points to leadership that talks a big game on democracy, but behind the scenes isn't all that interested in it. In 2009, she condoned a coup in Honduras, even though the United Nations and others condemned it. Clinton secretly negotiated with coup leaders to ensure fast elections and that the former president would not return. Since then, Honduras has been rife with drug violence and police corruption. It has the highest homicide rate in the world, which is part of the reason so many migrants have become U.S. asylum seekers. Given all that, who's Clinton hoping to attract with this record?
It's very difficult to perceive who within the Democratic primary electorate she's trying to woo over with an extremely hostile and antagonistic foreign policy.
So, is Hillary the commander-in-chief the Democrats want and that America really needs?
Well, just remember, she said that they have a good government there. They do not. In fact, outside of Syria, the second largest bastion for ISIS is in Libya. But you also have all of Gaddafi's former arms, which were a massive group, and now they're spread out all over that area of the Middle East and are being used by all forms of terrorists. So that's something she can't put back on the box. The fact that it's a completely destroyed country, that people have taken over the oil and not giving any of it to the Libyan people, that starvation is common in Libya, where they never had starvation. In fact, the Libyans had the highest quality, highest standard of living of any country in Africa. And they also had no crime. They had no terrorism. And this is, for 40 years, this was going on. So they need to have someone who can challenge her when it comes to her being wrong. Now, let's go over and listen to a police officer, a highly decorated police officer, telling a council what it means for them not to be open to other forms of therapy for his child when he saw the results of orthodox medicine failing and alternative medicine succeeding. Please listen.
I'm an 11-year veteran of the San Francisco Police Department. I hold the department's highest medal of honor for bravery. That used to mean a lot more to me than it does now. What I'd like to talk to you about today is my now 7-year-old daughter. This is an identical twin. Her sister is now dead. Her sister, when she was 4 years old, Kristen, developed a highly malignant brain tumor that had spread throughout her spine and her brain. The doctors told us that we had really two options: take her home, let her die, or bring her in for massive dosages of chemo and radiation simultaneously. In either event, she was going to die. They were quite certain of that, and very quickly. Believing her only chance to be the standard route, we gave her the chemo and radiation. It burned her skull so bad she had second-degree burns and her hair never came back. To change her diapers, we had to wear rubber gloves because her urine was so toxic and it burned her. At the end of 6 months, miraculously, she survived the standard treatment, although there was a high expectation she wouldn't. She still had cancer. We were told, sorry, we've done everything we can. Now she's going to die, probably within a couple of months. My wife and I, choosing not to accept that, started reading. The first book I picked up, the third chapter, discussed Dr. Brzezinski. As you may guess, I have some expertise in fraud. In fact, I'm quite certain there are enough attorneys in the room that I could be voir dired as an expert in fraud. And I conducted my own investigation. I have no doubt the man is not a fraud. I have no doubt that he does what he does out of earnest belief that his medicine works. And now you're in a position to judge for yourselves whether it works or not, but it's well established by the FDA that it's non-toxic. 18 months later, we took my daughter off the antineoplastin. She had not died. She had no signs of tumor. She remained free for 18 months of cancer. Within a month, the cancer was widespread in her brain. We put her back on Brzezinski's. By the way, at the objections of our doctors, for some reason felt that it had failed her. We put her back on. Within 9 weeks, the tumor was completely gone. She died last July of neurological necrosis. Her brain fell apart from the radiation. The autopsy showed that she was completely cancer-free. Out of 52 cases of that disease ever, no one died cancer-free, just Chrissy. So she didn't die of a terminal illness. She died of my inability to care for her properly, and she died from bad advice. She died because there's a government institution that disseminates false information and is not looking out for the welfare of the people. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I swore an oath 11 years ago, and I think most of us in this room swore it at one time or another to uphold the Constitution. It says life right in the beginning.
That is one father's experience. Dr. Stanislaw Brzezinski therapy, the antineoplasm, was able to eliminate all terminal cancer in that child's body, but she died of the effects of radiation. That is not unusual. He was there to try to defend the use of a Brzezinski therapy, but he's up against an enormously powerful $100 billion cancer industry, and they're not going to surrender their money and power for something that is able to be inexpensive, non-toxic, and helps actually heal cancer. That's something I know a lot about because I was the one who wrote the article that ended up as a special on 60 Minutes that, or 2020, that won two Emmys that help reestablish Brzezinski and give him an opportunity to use his therapy. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. And we will play the segment part two about the Israeli soldier on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.